There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Let's just start again.
I've got Parky on the big screen, and it's like a huge, big, looming Parky. It's even bigger than life size.
Fascinating. I wonder which part of Let's Start Again you just ignored. all right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this. It is Pilot Episodes, the podcast for the aviation enthusiast. But don't worry, I won't be flying alone because I'll be joined by other enthusiasts. So we'll start, of course, with skin cream enthusiast, Parky. How are you, mate?
I'm good. Luckily, the first intro was a disaster, so I'm bracing myself for the skin cream intro, and I still don't really understand.
Well, you have a muse about it.
Quite.
Well, that wouldn't be understood either, Dunk.
Parky, if you could see the picture I'm seeing of your face, you'd understand why he talked about skin cream.
Much like a tortoise, Parky doesn't really do much in the winter months. So what have you been doing? A bit of DIY or something?
Tortoise, good. Yeah, DIY, building a wall, another one. So not the great deal that would really fit in with this podcast.
How many walls do you need at your house? We JB, this is an ongoing theme because even however many years ago, 6-7 years ago, when I was flying at Coningsby, we used Parky's wall as a navigational feature because you can see it from space.
Goodness me, where do you live, Parky? The Mexican border?
That is an exaggeration, my God. You can see it from a chippy at 1,000 feet.
But oh, wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah, big wall. Now, this is a retaining wall for my oil tank.
Wow. Well, the voice you could hear previously was coffee carrying enthusiast Godders. So Godders, tell me you've been doing some things other than building walls this last few weeks.
I've done a few admirals and generals, a cup of tea and coffee here or there. You know, that's been quite good. What have I been doing? I've been doing all sorts of things. One that stands in the memory this week is I was invited to New Zealand House for Waitangi Day.
Oh, I saw this on your Twitter.
Yeah, which is the New Zealand National Day. It was utterly brilliant because New Zealand House, it's visible from Trafalgar Square because it's this 17-storey, reasonably ugly, I think Prince Charles called it a carbuncle, in a view from Buckingham Palace. But they've got the best view of any view in London at the top of this thing. And they did a really good, the defence attaché did a chat, and then they had this, it was a Maori lawyer come up, talked a lot in Maori, and then explained a huge amount about the history of New Zealand and the treaty that they did Waitangi Day up in Waitangi, in North Island. And then did the, I put it on Twitter, but a brilliant hacker. I tell you what, JB, so in your other life of rugby enthusiast, expert and podcaster, I don't know whether you've ever faced a hacker, but you saw that. That was only sort of five guys and a couple of women doing hacking. It's quite a thing. I can imagine it being a little bit scary with the All Blacks facing you doing a full hacker war dance.
Well,
it's going to get them fired up.
I will say this. I have been pitch level, actually on the same pitch as All Black, I can't remember his name now, the massive number six, Jerome Kano, running straight towards me. He was exactly that sort of man. And I can tell you right now, an intimidating presence. And as much as I give the habit stick, you can listen to my other podcast for that one. I do appreciate it. It is It is quite a sight.
Yeah, honestly, it was amazing. And you know, you can see whatever the troubles have been with you know, the sort of Maori and British culture over the years, everyone has embraced it now, you know, and he called it a bicultural society. But the warrior side of the Maori is something that the New Zealand military have embraced, you know, the New Zealand army. And there, some people are talking fantastic stories of, you know, sort of Second World War and just bravery down to warrior spirit. So it was a brilliant night. Brilliant
Excellent.
Evening.
Now, just whilst we're on New Zealand, do they have an air force at the moment? They used to fly A4s, did they not, back in the day? Old Australian A4s?
Yeah, they did.
They all of a sudden just quit the fast jets, didn't they? The A4s.
They did, yeah.
2004, I'm thinking, something like that. Because there was an exchange. Was it a JAG guy who used to go?
No, it was Finn.
Finn was the last exchange.
There you go.
Yeah, so I think they bought the A4 off Australia and then sold it them back. That's what I think. Anyway.
No, I think that they had ex-US Navy A4s.
Yeah.
I think.
Did they? I don't know.
But those A4s are back flying in America again for a company called, I think it's Draken.
You're right. They are. They are aggressive.
Because when I was a couple of years ago flying with 2 Squadron out at Nellis on Green Flag, these guys were the aggressors. And so they'd bought up a bunch of A4s from around the world. And so those New Zealand ones were back flying again because they were pretty silly done up with I think it was an APG 65, you know, an F-16 radar in the front.
Oh, nice. Yes. Well, I guess we better introduce the third of our cadre, resident snuff film enthusiast.
Where's that come from?
Belter.
How are you, mate?
I'm all right, yeah. I'm slightly, you know, I could kind of work out, right, we've got Parky's face with his skin cream. We've got Gosney coffee, but now I'm flummoxed.
Well,
come on, can you explain it?
Look, if it needs to be explained, you haven't listened to enough of these podcasts. However, what I'm more interested in is what you've been doing for the last couple of weeks since we spoke last. Now, you've been meddling with Texans. I don't mean the people, I mean the aircraft.
A little bit of the people and
That's
a little
why
bit
he,
of the
Yeah, he's yeah. not out into Texas again.
They're building another wall just against me.
With those Texans,
I got away with that one. Yeah, I've been doing a bit of Texan ground school, which is interesting. So the aeroplanes hopefully will fly soon. Can't really talk very much about that, I'm afraid, but fingers crossed they will.
Have you got a sim? The simulator?
The simulator is... It works, but it's not been...
ratified.
Ratified or accredited.
I'm amazed, actually, that you've asked that question, Goddess, because for me, just an outsider, I always think something like a Texan is there... Tell me if I'm wrong. It's there to train pilots, yes?
Yes.
So are you doing pre-training training then using simulators? And is that what you do with other models of aircraft?
The way that we do it on all of the modern platforms now is pretty much the guys learn far more than we used to. The simulators didn't have such high fidelity. They learn how to, you know, fly the aircraft, land it, take it off, land it, and, you know, fly a bit in the middle in the simulator. So actually when they get to the real aircraft... They've done it a fair amount, and there is a difference when you get in the real aircraft, as we've spoken about in podcasts before, and the sort of the fear factor and other psychological factors that sort of that come into play. But they're far better prepared now than we were, I suppose, back in the day.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm pretty confident that I could fly an A380 now.
Yeah.
We've seen you do it. You can.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I got some poor instruction on the last landing, but it went swimmingly. Now we're podcasting on a rather.
I'm surprised you haven't been given a job yet, actually, JB. As you clattered into the cockpit, they thought actually there's no way. It's not your flying ability; it's just getting in and out.
It's sort of public image, watching the pilot clatter into his seat, knocking things everywhere. It's just not a good look, is it?
Trailing toilet roll behind you.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say we're podcasting on a special week, but I suppose it is special. I guess, a bit sad because the Tornado is finally retired, right?
Yeah.
From operations. So yeah. It's not quite retired just yet.
Okay.
But the last three came back from Cyprus this week and landed back at Marham. So, yeah, that's the end of, I think, continuous operations since 1991 for the tornado.
Is that right?
Isn't it? Unbelievable. It's got to be almost a record, isn't it?
Well, I tell you a record which really stood out to me because it's been all over social media and whatnot. There is a guy. Now, Porky, you've got a lot of hours in fast jets. There's a guy who's got 6,000 hours as a navigator in Tornado, which is just astounding.
Yeah.
You only have to sit in the back, though, don't they? To be honest. He's walking past.
It's like, just right. Alien. Oh.
Ooh, crikey.
Come on. Really, do you think that I wasn't alienated before?
So you're just belittling Stratus's 6,000 hours sat in the back of a tornado.
He just had to say it, didn't he?
Okay. Should we get our special guest this evening?
I always wondered how Dunk ended up. I always wondered how Dunk ended up in single seat aircraft. I think I know.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Parky, what's clearly we all know that I haven't got 1,000 hours in any aeroplane, but what's your high number? Is it on Hawks or?
It would be, Hawks, 1,500 odd hours, I guess, 1,600 hours, maybe, something like that.
Don't get you up.
That is ridiculous. That is unbelievable amount of hours in the back of a GR.
It's amazing.
Doing all the work as well, I can say this, having done a few sims in the front seat up at Lossiemouth, I never flew in the front seat. But it is the navigator that does everything. It's flipping brilliant. I wished I'd gone two seat a lot earlier in my life. It's a lot easier.
So was changed. Is the F3 single seat? Or was it two seat?
The F3 was like the GR4 was two seats, and it just had a different role. But I mean, I can remember I was checked out in the back seat, and on one exercise I had to fly. The boys were flying with the Darth Vader kit, the AR-5, so, the sort of full chemical weapon stuff. So you had to have a guy that was qualified in the back in case this thing sort of steamed up and you could take over. So I remember...
Parky, can I just interject there? Where the chemical protection stuff, not the chemical weapon stuff. Remember, it's the bad guys that do that.
yes, quite.
But the... I can remember just having to scramble.
He's very picky tonight, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
I knew what you meant, Parky. The chemical weapon stuff.
I was in the back seat of this thing, JB, and it was a sort of scramble, and I had to kind of write it down and do some typing and get the inertial nav sorted and do the radios and get airborne. And then obviously operate the radar. And I just worked my knackers off. I wasn't that for the tactical bit, and operating the radar in the back. And it was brutal. And, you're just sort of sitting there and you've got some bloke throwing this jet around. So, it's just quite unpleasant, to be honest. I couldn't wait till we landed off that sortie.
Wow. Did you have one navigator or one, maybe that's not the term, but one guy that you flew with predominantly throughout your career? Or do you rotate or how does it work?
Yes, the program is written. You flew pretty much with... anybody, I guess, on the squadron. You had the more junior guys would fly with the more senior pilots, more often than not. If you did ops, you would be crewed up with somebody. If you did big exercises, you would as well. The Falklands, you'd fly with the same bloke. So, but day to day on the squadron, it'd be sort of hit and miss who you flew with.
And what kind of information do they give you?
Well, it depends on the role. In the Tornado F3, they were operating the radar, which I guess they're kind of doing in the backseat of the ground attack, the GR4. But it's really the weapon system. So they do a lot in terms of they operate the pod, and all of that stuff is done from the backseat, Godders.
Yeah. So, the sims
weapon
that I...
Delivery, a lot of it is from the backseat.
Yeah, the sims that I did... the guys are entering all the weapons data in the back, sorting out the targets. You're essentially in the front, accepting the targets. You can bring certain bits of information up in the front. But clearly there were, with me, an inexperienced guy in the front seat of this in the simulator, not having gone through the conversion course, they are probably doing more than they normally would because I mean, Parky, I guess if you flew with a good nav, you know, it's probably quite an easy thing when you, you know, sort of understood what each other was going to do. It was probably quite easy to fly around the place and took a lot of pressure off you, and you took a lot of pressure off him or her.
Interesting.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when you crewed up with a good, it was great. I really enjoyed flying with, you know, F4 and F3. It was, you know, those aircraft were designed for it. You know, they were sort of the things in the cockpit and the workload. You know, it was designed for two-seat operations. And, you know, at times you'll remember in the Typhoon, you know, you could be working pretty hard when it gets busy in there. But, you know, I guess the cockpit was designed in, you know, to do everything. But every now and again, a second pair of eyes and a second brain, you know, it was useful, especially my brain.
So who is in charge of the aircraft itself? Is that always the pilot?
Yeah, I'm trying to think now. This is a very good question. So the aircraft captain, you would always sign for the jet, yeah, and you would be the aircraft captain, but the authorizer, so somebody would authorize the sortie, and that could actually be the bloke on the ground, bizarrely, behind the desk, but the auth would generally be the most sort of senior guy and the leader of that formation. So that could often be, you know, the navigator would be the, we call it the authorizer of that trip.
Oh,
so that's quite a strange thing. So, I mean, that's probably worth explaining, JB, is when you brief a sortie, you know, either if you're flying on your own or you're flying with a four ship or you're flying with an eight ship, there is a qualification that someone has on the squadron that will authorize that. So basically they are saying that you've briefed, you've done all the mission planning, they are experienced enough to understand you've done everything well and you're cleared to go out the door. Now, clearly you can self-authorize once you get to a certain point. So as an example, when I was a station commander, I was the only one that could authorize certain things, you know, like a Diamond 9 formation, you know, that sort of stuff. So people had to explain to you how they were briefing it. You'd sit on the brief sometimes, you'd listen to what their plan was. And when they got to the desk, so you'd run through an out brief. So you'd all get kitted up, go to the authorizing desk on the squadron, and whoever was behind the desk or the authorizing officer would run through this big long checklist to make sure you'd done everything. You check the weather, you check the NOTAMs, the notice to airmen, all of these sorts of things. You know, final little checks, you go and sign for the aeroplane and off you go. So someone has authorized the trip, and then all the captains then sign another line saying that they'll comply with those orders. So it's not as simple as just find an aeroplane and go flying.
No, I bet not. Now, I imagine that you've done lots of work with Tornado in the past, you being a Harrier guy. Just tell me a little bit about the capability of the Tornado and what would that do which the Harrier couldn't, and vice versa. How would the two aircraft interact when they were both serving alongside each other?
Well, sort of back in the day when we would do Cameos and things like that, they get tasked against different stuff. They would have their own weapons effect. And to be honest, you wouldn't really be looking too much into what they were doing. You'd know perhaps where their, you know, where their weapons were being sent. But you know, the things that that Tornado could do that Harrier couldn't, really, and I think probably Harrier's downfall was down to Storm Shadow. I think, you know, the ability for it to carry and deliver that. So I think to answer your question, sort of day on day, you didn't sort of have a working knowledge of how Tornado worked and what it did. The way that we would plan things, because it wouldn't just be Harriers and Tornadoes, there are all sorts of different platforms, different nations. They all delivered different effect. And so the mission commander on what we called a combined air operation or a Cameo, he would be told, right, this is the effect that we want. And then he would use his weapon systems to try and provide that effect with using, you know, other weapon systems such as air defense fighters to defend those systems and go against. So the suppression of enemy air defenses would happen to try and take out surface to air missiles. It's a huge, big, complicated picture. And the real nitty gritty of how the different weapon systems worked, I would say, wasn't really required by anyone but the mission commander, who did need to know, you know, what each platform could do, what they could carry, how many, and therefore, you know, what systems he could either take out and what weapons he could put onto each individual target. So it sort of all came together through that mission commander, I would say. Goddess, what do you think?
Yeah, I'd go along with the fact that we used to do the big combined exercises in the UK. You would all plan together. So that's when the weapons instructor courses that we do. So you'd have to understand how to integrate particular capabilities into the formations, because that's all about becoming a mission commander. So understanding this huge level of different types of aircraft and capabilities and how you put them together. I mean, I'd operated with Tornado closely a couple of times when we were doing Libya in 2011. We did end up flying mixed formations I was the chief of staff down at Jor del Col, where we were flying out of. And there were mixed formations there because Typhoon could provide, you know, had the radar, had Link 16, had a bunch of capabilities that could protect Tornado. Tornado had a wider suite of weapons available to it, one of them being Brimstone, which Typhoon now has. And Brimstone, an amazing bit of kit, actually. I wasn't a fan earlier on in the day because this thing was designed a sort of Cold War design. So you'd loose off this small little derivative of a Hellfire missile. It had a millimetric wave radar in the front, and it had an autonomous mode where you could give it a search pattern. It'd go, and it'd look for tank-shaped objects. It had its own little library in it and go, yeah, that looks like a tank. Check in the library. Definitely is a tank, not a school bus, and go for it. So I always wondered how we were going to use that in the modern day with rules of engagement. But MBDA, who built it, added a dual mode to it, and they put a laser receiver in there. And one particular night in Libya, I saw the guys come back, and this tornado had there was a T-72 tank causing havoc down this street, you know, so a bunch of civilians around. So you can't drop a big bomb in that, because clearly you do not want any collateral damage. You know, you don't want to kill any civilians or any of that sort of stuff. So a lot of the big bombs were out. So the only thing that was actually cleared to shoot in that particular night was a Tornado, which used a laser guided Brimstone, and the shot went literally up the street. It's a fairly low yield warhead, hit the tank, disabled the tank, and you could still see, you know, it didn't affect any of the houses around or any of that sort of stuff. So was a really low collateral weapon that was, sort of perfect precision, you know, sort of taking that tank out in the middle of the street. So Brimstone from then on became the sort of weapon of choice doing close air support. And it's only recently, in the last few months, that Typhoon has got that capability, which has been, you know, has allowed Tornado to then retire. So there's a lot of there's a lot of sort of complementary. You know, another reason Typhoon flew with Tornado as well was the electronic warfare detection system on Typhoon is so good that it could differentiate between certain things that maybe Tornadoes couldn't at time. You know, there was a bunch of different reasons, but it was really successful when we did the sort of the dual fighter operations.
That is very interesting. Don't mean to be that not a missile; it's a range of missiles. So
the other thing, JB, I think as well, is it was an incredibly close decision between which aircraft they took out of service. You know, it was. I think it even changed the decision, you know, a couple of times as to was it going to be the Harrier, was it going to be the Tornado? Because, you know, there were plus and minuses, I guess, but it went to the wire, didn't it, between which was going to, go out of service. Eventually, I think the Harrier, it was quite short notice, wasn't it, Dunk? You know, you boys were just waiting, weren't you, to find out which it was, and suddenly Harrier was gone, and 6 months later, that was it.
Yeah, I can't remember if we banged on about this before, but I was bizarrely I was on the ops desk. I can remember. It's one of those things that you have a snapshot in your mind. And I was the auth on the desk that day. It was a beautiful blue sky. And the first wave, I'd outbriefed all of them. They were all walking out to the aeroplanes. And the phone, and it was the forward commander who was, I think it was Air Commodore Waterfall, might have been group captain, can't remember. But he was the forward commander anyway that time. And he said, Dunk, have they got airborne in the first wave yet? I said, no, not yet. So they're just walking out now. Stop them. was like, oh, miserable. Yeah. So that, you know, that was it. That
were you not tempted to tell us a little porky so the boys could get in the air one final time?
Sorry, I can't hear what you said.
Send them flying. Okay.
Get them all up in the air. All right, then. Yeah, because I might fly a little differently if you knew that that was your last day in the aircraft.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a, that is a exactly the oath on the radio. Right, boys, it's your last one. Make the most of it. Make it count. Yeah, so it's probably best at that point to all sort of come back and take stock. But yeah, of course, everyone
that,
then does.
That last trip, Uncle, then, or that was just...
No, what so what that? Happened is that they then... I mean, there was a huge amount of change. I was on the operational conversion unit at the time. So that's where we train the students who are coming out of Valley to become Harrier pilots. And they stopped that day. So from being on that course and, you know, wherever they were in it, some were quite close to the end. Some had just started. But all of those guys stopped flying. And Gary Waterfall at the time, he managed, which I thought was, it was great. He managed to keep the aeroplane flying for an extra 3 months. And we went and did support to ops. So we'd go and support the army on Stanta Range and do close air support with those guys. So it wasn't like, right, that's it. You're grounded and there is no more Harrier flying. It had sort of almost a decompression period, if you like, where we did then still support those guys on the ground and then phased the aircraft out, and they did a 16 ship fly past for the on the final day of the jet, which I think the Tornado is going to do as well.
I did know that story, but I didn't realize what you were doing that day. You were in charge of the conversion unit, so there would be no point in sending those boys up, to be fair.
Well, I wasn't in charge of the conversion unit. I was just the author on the desk.
He thought he was, JB.
I've always thought in charge of everything. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
exactly.
I'm not.
Punky, don't tell him. Don't tell him. It upsets him.
Starts twitching. There wouldn't have been much point if it was a student sortie and everything was stopping, as you say. Some of those sorties, though, you end up doing. You know, go and do staff continuation training and things like that. But I suppose if it was finishing, there's no point in continuing to train if the aircraft wasn't going to fly.
We had the same sort of thing up at Lockheed. Sig Froome, Paul Froome was the boss on 15 Squadron. And it was once the last course through, the last weapons instructor course had gone through, that's essentially when everyone stopped flying because you've got no reason to keep flying.
Yeah.
But all that we did was keep the guys current who were then going to do the flypast for the last for the parade on the last day, and then you know the thing gradually wound down, and that's it. It was a sad day when the last Tornado left Lossie, because it was good having the two different forces up there. And one of the things I said to them at the time was, with Typhoon getting Storm Shadow and Brimstone, that if the guys weren't briefing each other to each other, do stuff. We had some of the Tornado guys coming over to Typhoon as well. One of the Tornado guys was going off to F-35. You know, there was a huge chance to sort of learn off each other at that point, which was actually really good. There weren't many of our bases back in that were multi-platform bases. We were lucky out of Larbrook. We had the helicopter guys out there. You know, which was good to, you know, chat with them, although they went an awful lot of the time. But it was just a good thing. You know, other times in Cyprus, when I've been co-located with fighter controllers, that has been brilliant, that you can sit in and debrief with them, see exactly what they get to, go and sit in the radar cabins with them and see how it is to control. It's like Parky sitting in the back of an F3 and finding out what a nav does for a living. You know, all of that stuff is really good to see what other people do.
I think what's interesting is that Parky was absolutely... heads on fire in the back of that Tornado, completely capacity limited. Ooh, what's going on?
I mean, serious question then. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of stuff to do in the back of a Tornado. Otherwise, you wouldn't have someone there. How do you cope in a single seat? Because Harrier is basically the same generation. Presumably, you've got all the same work to do.
Yeah, I am. I mean, yeah, you do. You've got, Goddess, you flew in Tornado a bit, didn't you?
A couple of trips I had in the back seat.
Yeah. So, I mean, I do know it is really difficult because I don't think you can compare apples with apples. But, you know, the Harrier was, you know, it had a lot of stuff that was provided to the pilot to enable him to do things single seat. I think probably it's probably fair to say that you needed to have, you know, more capacity than the guy flying the Tornado, because you were operating the whole system rather than just, you know, flying the aeroplane whilst, as the boys have said, the guy in the back did, you know, the majority of the workload. So, I think the systems within it, they're just designed differently such that, you know, I guess as the aircraft were developed, those single seat systems were easier for a single pilot to operate.
Yeah, I mean, the thing which strikes me about the Tornado is the sheer amount of roles that it occupied. Everyone thinks of the ground attack, but you had the reconnaissance variant, which was top of its game for a long, long time. You had maritime strike version, and that's before you even get into the interceptor version.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good point. There are lots of versions in there. I remember when the GR1A came out, you know, it had didn't have one of the guns removed because it had a sideways looking infrared on both sides. Used to carry even right up until the end, carrying the Raptor pod, which was a great mechie pod that provided that sort of tactical recce. The EW side of it, the suppression of enemy air defences, SEED, you know, which is all I did in the F-16 out in the States. The alarm missile.
We're using, what was it, HARM missiles?
Yeah, HARM out in the States, the AGM-88, which is a US missile. The Germans use them on their ECR Tornadoes, their electronic Tornadoes. We had a great missile actually called Alarm, you know, which was one of these things that, so if you wanted it, so there's an enemy radar out there attached to a fire control system, a surface-to-air missile, and if you wanted to take it and fire one of these, normally an anti-radiation missile finds the beam of the radar and it basically sniffs it out and follows that beam all the way down to source and then blows up. So you're taking out the dish or whatever is providing the signal, but clearly turn it off, there is no signal. So the Alarm used to put out a parachute in loiter mode and sit in its parachute waiting for someone to twitch, and then if someone twitched and turned it back on, it would snip the parachute and go back down. So it was a really good missile and a great role for Tornado to do.
Did they used to call those missions Wild Weasel missions? Have I made that up?
No, in the US they're called Weasel. Something the Brits, we never really called it that, but definitely I was a Wild Weasel out in the States when I was doing that particular job.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because I seem to remember, I think the Israelis did the same sort of thing, but they did it with drones. They had rudimentary drones flying about. And as soon as they switched on their radars, that's when they'd launch their HARM missiles.
I was on a red flag once, and there was a big Israeli detachment there flying F-15s, and they had a bunch of it. So this was, I guess, maybe 2000 or so, 2000. And I was chatting to a couple of their fighter pilots in the bar, really interesting guys.
I bet.
And I was talking to one of them about, you know, electronic warfare and that sort of stuff, and how they do their training. And this guy told me back in the day, so it was, he was talking about the 80s. I forget what aeroplane he was flying, maybe the Skyhawk or something like that. He said you used to take the guys up and their sort of defense against SAM 6 mission, they'd hug along the border and hope that a SAM 6 was fired against them, and then use their tactics to stop actually being hit by a real SAM 6 that was in the air.
Crikey.
That is training.
Yes. it sounds rather nerve-wracking. Before I move on from Tornado, anyone else want to share any Tornado-related anecdotes before we talk about something else?
What was the photo wing called, Parky? 67-degree wing. All photographs.
The thing I can remember, the best thing about the Tornado was, and I think I've said this before, it was ridiculously quiet when you flew it.
Yes.
It was when you did 600 knots, every bit you do you know, so you're trucking, you're doing, I don't know, whatever, 660 miles an hour, you're nearly supersonic, and you feel it in, you know, the Harrier would, well, wouldn't go that fast, but, you know, if it did vertically, it would feel like it was falling apart, probably. Whereas a tornado, it was mentally quiet and smooth, and you pop the wings back. And I remember we always used to do sort of 100-foot breaks at 600 knots on the display, and it would just make people jump, and you just, it was ridiculously good fun. But I can remember lining up at Blackpool, and Grigo did it to me, and I heard him sort of, he was joining, and it was, I wondered, I was on the runway ready to get airborne. He was going to do a break. When he was downwind, I was then going to take off. And he came over the top of me at, I guess, 100 foot with the blowers in, and it would have been quiet in his cockpit. And I jumped out of my skin in my aircraft. The just the noise, and it's just suddenly there. Such a fast bit of machinery at a low level. And this is where it wanted to be honest. It was
your skin's quite baggy, though, isn't it? So I suppose, you know, jumping out of it wasn't too much of a problem.
Oh, Parky. You've just reminded me, actually. Because you're not on Twitter, but Lego Parky is on Twitter.
Yeah.
Two things have just combined them. One is, who was the gentleman who got shot down in the Gulf War?
John Nicol.
John Nicol tweeted you this week. At least he tweeted your Lego alter ego, saying that you actually flew together, which was quite nice. And the other thing which you missed on...
We've lost Parky.
Oh, dear. Well, the other thing that you missed, Parky, was an amazing video of a tornado flyby. Did you see that?
That was a bell, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was brilliant. Because the first one goes past, you think, that's quite close. And then you see the guy in the tower craning his neck around, like, that can't be another tornado. And then right past the tower.
That's what it did well. It was, you know, it has served the RAF ridiculously well, that jet.
Yeah. Well, was it originally TSR-2 technology which went into it?
I heard that.
The TSR-2 was, went, that was actually binned, and we bought, or the RAF bought the Phantom. So they went off the shelf, you know, so that would have been sort of mid-60s because the F4 came in 68. But there may have been some technology in the sort of train following radar, that sort of thing, that then, you know, when was the sort of first flight of Tornado? Was sort of 70?
74.
Help me out, they got 74, there you go. So it wasn't that much after, you know, the F4s were still, you know, pretty new that we were then jumping on board the, you know, the European Panavia Tornado at the time.
Yeah. One last thing for you then, if anyone wants to...
Just a sec, have you ever seen the TSR-2? There's one up at, I think I mentioned it before, there's one up at Cosford.
There's one in Duxford too.
It's enormous.
I know.
It looks like a cross between a tornado and... Yeah, there was an episode in Thunderbirds with some... some big sort of cranked wing bomber that they had to roll the little Thunderbird on because it had lost an undercarriage.
Oh, I do remember that. Exactly the one you mean. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly the one, yeah.
And it looks like one of these things. It's enormous. And I think you're right. There was a ton of technology, not least the air brakes, which are in exactly the same place.
Oh, are they? Yeah, there's one in Duxford too. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it is one of the largest, most scandalous bits of industrial sabotage ever to occur in the UK. But it is what it is. It's, what, nearly 50 years ago now.
Yeah,
let it go.
Let it go, JB.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Very, very, very wise words. Who's been watching the Red Arrows show thing, which is going on Channel 5 at the moment?
Yeah, I watched an episode last night. It was the first one I'd seen.
And what's the review?
I thought it was good. I mean, I know a couple of the guys in there, obviously, Lingy Purty, the boss, and then a couple of guys who were trying out. But boys, did you talk?
Yeah, I've seen a couple. Was the one last night then on the shortlist of the boys joining?
Yes, it was.
And I've still got to see that one. But yeah, I saw sort of, you know, Lingy coming back in the team, and it's great. I mean, it's just a trip down memory lane, you know, where they put their helmets and the briefing room and the same little magnetic hawks on the board. You know, it's just all those sort of weird stuff that you just remember it coming back. But I've enjoyed it. It's good. And, you know, I think it's a it's a very watchable thing, isn't it? Because it's one of those, we're going to do it, it's a nightmare. Oh, we've done it, brilliant. You know, that's kind of what it's like most years. You know, you climb that mountain and you put the show on. But no, it's been good.
What was the shortlist like for you, Dunk?
What, when I was there?
Yeah.
Can't believe we allowed him on.
Yeah, do you know, it's funny. I think we may have said this before, and it won't be surprising anyone, I would imagine. But, you know, when you're on the shortlist, there's always what you call a tough nut to crack. So one of the team that you always think, oh, flipping heck, he's quite hard work. He clearly doesn't like me. He's a little bit aloof, a little bit, yeah, check me out. I'm quite a big deal around here. For me, that guy was Parco. You know, I wouldn't have thought it, but yeah, Parco was a tough nut to crack. I can't believe you let me on, Parky.
Well, I've done some navigation exams with Dunk. I don't know why we were doing those, Dunk, but we'd done some exams here. So I kind of knew Dunk pretty well. So I guess that was...
He was ignoring me.
You just read me wrong, Dunk. You read me wrong.
So, hang on. Have you all been on the Reds?
God, it hasn't.
Oh, dear. I thought you had a
too
thousand...
busy getting promoted.
I was too busy flopping missions from my exchange tour.
I thought you had 1,000 hours on the Reds. Sorry. No. That's completely wrong.
Well, no, God, it would, yeah.
I'd be well spreading 1,000. That's like a, you know, people touch the sort of Manchester United... badge before they run out at Old Trafford and stuff like that. You know, my lucky charm is not getting 1,000 hours in any aeroplane.
Exactly.
You've done well. You are a very
So last night, so they had the shortlist, and I heard, you know, you guys and various others talk about it. Is it always the same? A turn up, there's some sort of social, there's a, even though they were in Greece, they still seem to be doing the go-karting. There's an interview and there's a flying test. Has it been the same for a million years?
They normally play golf as well. Did they play golf?
Didn't see that bit.
Ah, well, I don't know. They might not anymore, but they used to play golf all the time. And it's as good, I think, as you can get in a week, in that, you know, you fly with people, you socialize with people, you go and look at things that perhaps people wouldn't normally do. That might be golf or it might be go-karting. And so you put people in an environment where they're relatively uncomfortable, because the fact is everyone knows it's a 24-hour-a-day interview for 6 days or however long the board is there for. So, you know, you're always under the spotlight. So it's, you know, you always used to say you could tell someone who's feeling the pressure, because, you know, they'd laugh even at things that weren't particularly funny. You know, they'd have a short list laugh. That's it. So, because there's that pressure on people, you kind of probably see as best you can the true person. You know, when they're under pressure, they're a bit tired, they're flying 3 times a day doing, you know, it is quite, the flying is quite high pressure as well. So you probably see the real side of those 9 people on the shortlist, and it gives you a good indication of perhaps who you should select.
All right, I've got loads of questions now. So first of all, why does a pilot want to join the Reds?
Well, I guess everyone's slightly different. So some people join the Air Force wanting to join the Reds. That's what they've seen, and that's what they, you know, what they joined for. I personally didn't. I didn't even think that I wanted to join the Reds. I was at Valley as an instructor, and there was the opportunity to fly with them. And, you know, I was of the mindset, well, you know, that's a tick in the box of life. Why not go and give it a go? And so, went and gave it a go. And when you fly, it's one thing watching the team from the outside and thinking, oh, they're 9 in 5, but actually when you see the dynamics of the maneuvering from inside the formation, it's even as a fast jet pilot that's used to maneuvering fairly close to other aircraft, it is absolutely jaw-dropping. And so I saw that and thought, right, I'm going to apply to do that. So, you know, that's my story. I don't know, Parky, what was your thoughts?
I mean, yeah, it was one of those, didn't think I stood a chance. And I guess I was sort of saw them a fair bit when I was doing the F3 display. I met a few of the boys, and like you, Dunk, I don't know if I managed to blag a trip, but the more I saw of it, the more it was just like, this is ridiculously fun, for want of a better word, flying. Just utterly what you can do with 9 aircraft, you know, looping, rolling, the second half manoeuvres. It was just fantastic. And backseat trips, it was like, I just, if I could get a shout at doing that, you know, and a short list and, you know, nothing ventured, just give it a go. And really didn't think I stood a chance. But it was, I think it's very, you know, I never really thought I stood a chance of getting in the Reds probably for the first 10 years, 3 tours. Like, it didn't even occur to me to apply for the Red Arrows.
Wow.
And I don't think I would have, hadn't, you know, got the solo display, to be honest. But, you know, some boys do a couple of tours and, you know, apply immediately. And it's a funny thing as well, you know, at that sort of stage of your career, you're probably, I mean, not for me, but most boys are going to get promoted and, you know, they're at that sort of window. So for Godders, you know, when you got your exchange, I guess you came back promoted and that was your window gone, wasn't it? You know, you weren't allowed to apply at that stage.
Yeah, I'd taken that different path because when I was on the Harrier.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I did, as Eurofighter 2000 was called at the time, I'd done the QI course and I was desperate to go and fly something with a radar and I could see Typhoon coming in and I wanted to go and fly it. So I purposely, you know, all I'd ever put down on my sort of career annual forms and stuff like that was that I wanted to go on exchange. And I was lucky enough to do it. So exactly that point, you know, I went off, did that, came back, and it was never an option, you know. So for me, I hadn't applied, I hadn't considered it. And then when I came back, it wasn't an option anyway.
That's really interesting. So what's the profile of a pilot who is going to go into the Reds then?
Well, at the time, we had to have 1500 hours, which was generally, you know,
still the same hours.
That would be the boys don't fly as much as, you know, we used to probably fly 250 hours a year, so, you know, that would be puppet now, sort of 6 years, two good tours, you probably had your sort of 1500 hours, whereas, you know, now it's maybe, you know, 3 tours, so 9 years or so of flying. But, you know, by that time, you know, a lot of guys are promoted, and I don't think, at the time, you couldn't have been promoted and be selected for the Reds. And equally, sometimes they were short of, you know, weapons instructors, so it might be sort of Harrier boys, and they'd only take one, you know, and there were two good guys that were, you know, wanted to be on the team. And there was a lot of, you know, just people's careers were also in the timeline of their promotion, etc., stop some really good guys, you know, not getting in. That's just how it was.
Well, and how many guys would normally apply per year? And how long can you stay on the Reds for?
I mean, I guess would it be sort of 20 or 30? I mean, that was, again, you know, there was a lot more options when Duncan and me were, you know, on the team. But, you know, quite a few. And then they shortlist nine, or that's how it used to be. And then 2 years, there were three slots. 1 year, there was two. They've changed it a little bit. A couple of the guys have stayed on longer now, so there haven't been always the three slots. There were sort of back in the day. And in Germany, you would do 3 years. But again, that sort of varied a little bit. A couple of, you know, either through accidents or, you know, my case, you know, as we talked to earlier, a guy called Jarvo got sick, so I came back and did a fourth year. But, you know, the norm is to do 3 years.
Wow. And do you still have your day job as well, or are you pure Reds?
Yeah, pure Reds. That's it, you know.
The workload's actually huge, JB. It's, you know, I mean, it doesn't sound like much, but flying three times a day every day, particularly when it's quite a steep learning curve because it's all maneuvers you've not done before. A lot of it's high G stuff. There's it really, you get to a Friday, if you've flown three times a day, you know, for your 5 days, then you get to a Friday afternoon and you're absolutely shattered.
So what, and when do you do your flying? Do you do it like before breakfast, then lunchtime one, and then afternoon tea? How's that all fit in?
It depends when you have breakfast, supposed to be, but I guess, you know, in your profession, you can have breakfast whenever you want, can't you? Is it breakfast about 11 for you?
Well, if I'm lucky, followed by a long brunch.
Yeah, so under those timings, yeah, we would probably fly before breakfast, and then we would we'd breakfast at 10.
What was it? It was normally like an 8:30 slot or something you were flying first,
yeah,
wasn't
so,
it?
And it depends. The thing is, during the workup, JB, joking aside, is that the... actually, the Synchro and Gippo guys, the Enid and Gippo guys, Enid are the front five, Gippo are back four. So you might have seven guys training because you might have just the Synchro. But you might have six slots a day. So you've got six flying slots. The first one might be at 8 o'clock takeoff, and then it just alternates throughout the day with guys, you know, jumping into different. We're not doing that. We're in the same position, but it depends what you're training for, which shapes you're training for as to whether you fly or you're flying a lot.
Wow. So, and you got to brief all those and then you got to debrief them all.
Yeah. So it was, you know, it was just incredibly slick, the whole procedure. You know, the briefing time was, it started when I first joined, it was 30 minutes. You started for 90 minutes before nine aircraft took off, which is incredible when you can start them up and taxi out. And, you know, the brief would be about 10 minutes. You'd, you know, there was no dawdling from then. You know, you'd put your kit on, walk to the aircraft, back in, start up nine Hawks. You'd generally strap in with about a minute to spare. The Hawk was so easy to start, you know, probably 3 minutes, nine aircraft, taxi out, 6 or 7 minutes to taxi out. And then you'd always take off on time. And, you know, it was just slick. You know, equally the debrief, you know, after landing, one of the guys would get the tape ready to go. And, you know, a couple of minutes after you took your G-suit off, you know, you'd all sit down, play the tape. And you'd do that sort of six times a day. You know, well, fly three times, dovetailing between, as Dunk says, you know, the either Synchro or Gippo and Enid. And you know, the day job, it was utterly brilliant and the most amazing experience.
One of the things, JB, is, I mean, the boys have been a bit nonchalant about it there, but I remember speaking to Dunk when he was going through the workup once he got into the team. Mm. And he was bloody miserable the whole time going, this is the hardest thing I've ever done in my time.
Sorry. Duncan was miserable.
It's difficult to leave. I've gone downhill since then.
Oh, right.
I guess, even at the end of your first year, Dunk, you were saying, oh, it's so tricky, you know, I guess, because you were seeing displays at various places for the first time. You've got your skin juice where you're the navigation lead or any of that sort of stuff, navigating on overseas tours and things like that. It was really interesting, you know, speaking to the boys who were in that, you know, you see on TV, it's amazing. You know, it's the easiest thing in the world. When actually, these boys are absolutely working.
The problem Dunk had was he was on the left-hand side and they would always bicker and fight and arm wrestle.
A lot of bickering and fighting on the left-hand side.
Was that in the debrief as to who'd done it wrong?
Yeah, well, it was generally me.
I mean, it actually is that, you know, if you do get a more vociferous character, you know, and I'm sure probably Duncan was somebody that was just maybe a bit more nibby. I can kind of recall, actually, it's all flooding back to me, the left-hand side. But, you know, it could get you down a bit, you know, because, you know, you're doing your best and clearly, you know, the guys outside you are often even not for mating on you. You're in their peripheral vision and they'll just, you know, if you're up it, down it, shallow, deep, you know, they'll just give you a hard time and probably rightly so. But it is, you know, it's hard work without that.
Yeah, that's difficult.
So really simple question for you all, and we'll go around. We'll start with Godders, then Dunk, and then finish with Parky. Really simple question. Reds, are they the best display team in the world?
Starting with me. So as a as an observer, yes.
Dunk.
Not having, and that's not even having flown.
Dunk.
Yeah, I think they are. And to be honest, I think that, you know, the display has continued to improve. They call it the Cyclone that they do now, and they bring Enid round crowd front in the first half with 8 and 9 are spotting around it. So it's like the Corkscrew, Parky. Have you seen that one? The team continues to develop the display and continue to bring fresh stuff to it. And I think they are as well. I think they continue to do a brilliant job.
Parky?
Yeah. It's one of those things, you know, the country, we're definitely a nation where we think we'll lose at cricket and we slag off our trains and it's what we are. But there is some utter affection for the Red Arrows. And, you know, so many time to remember this. You know, boys go, you are, you know, we're so proud of the Reds. And, you know, you have the history of the team. You know, they've been just, you know, essentially probably the best display team in the world. And I think the country thinks that. And it is a real, it's quite a weight on your shoulders, to be honest. You know, you mess it up, you know, God, you would know about it. But it's it's really good that, you know, the Reds have the support and the belief that I think they are the best in the world. And, you know, we should be definitely proud of them.
Who's number two then?
That's what I was going to ask next.
Who do you think? I mean, I've always been impressed with the Blue Angels just in terms of, it's not a dynamic display, and it's a while since I've seen them, but how close they fly and how solid that formation appears to be, whether they were flying Skyhawks, F4s, or F-18s.
Yeah, it's a different skill, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's a real different skill set. And I think, you know, my personal view of the Blue Angels is, yes, you know, as a pilot, I think it's very impressive to watch. But as a spectator, whereas, you know, the Italian team, you know, they've got typical Italian flamboyance, and I think, you know, that is a spectacular display, sometimes perhaps not as accurate, dare I say, or certainly not as the Blue Angels, but the dynamic element of it, I think, is very good. So I think they're good too.
Yeah, Dunk, when we were at Fairford, we saw, I think they were called the Black Knights. I think we were probably BBMFing at the time.
Are they?
And they were
Czech or
was
something?
That the Russian ones?
No, they were Far East. I'm thinking maybe Malaysia, or I need to Google them. But they were good, and I'm sure that I think they were a 9 ship, and they had a funky little Hawk F, even a slightly more swept wing, you know, sort of Alpha Jet meets Hawk. But it was a good show. That it was very, very good display. Those boys did.
Mm. Well, I know you were asking right at the beginning of the podcast, JB, what people have been up to. But one of the things I was up to, which was to go and fly with the Reds. So I did that week before last. And all the things we've just been speaking about, whenever you go back to the team, the professionalism, you know, the flair and flamboyance that that we spoke about and what they bring to the display, it just comes flooding back. And it's a real privilege to go back and fly with them. And I flew back in the 9 slot as well that I used to fly in, and it was just a fantastic privilege to go back and fly with the boys.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie, Dunk, but when I do ask you what have you been doing over the last few weeks, and you get the men flying with the Reds, maybe learn from that.
I think you skipped it. You didn't ask me.
I most certainly did ask you. In fact, no,
we were
do you know what
we were talking about, JB, he's tricked you into bickering.
Do you know what? It was my mistake because I asked you a closed question. I said, have you been playing around with Texans?
Maybe there's a tiny bit of blame
for both of us. We'll discuss it in the debrief.
You don't hear that very often from JB, do you? My mistake.
Dunk, I've got a question for you, though. When you flew with them,
yeah,
did you wear a very faded pink suit?
Yeah, I dug mine out of the loft.
Slightly too tight around the wrong areas as you waddled out to the aeroplane.
Yeah, no, that's just your warped mind with it, you know, conjuring up its mental images again.
You still got your red suit?
I have one left, yeah, for special occasions.
So, Parky, Black Knights are from Singapore.
Yeah, I've just Googled as well. Now, the team we saw, Dunk, were the Black Eagles. I mean, they are, Google Black Eagles, Korean team. And you'll see they got a cool little aircraft as well. Very good.
Now, hang on. Singapore have their own jets, haven't they? Don't they make their own stuff?
I think they're flying F-16s. So they're flying, you know, genuine operational aircraft.
Singapore do fly F-16s. I'm thinking of Taiwan. That's what I'm thinking of.
Two of the Black Eagles from Korea.
Oh, there you go.
Always slightly obscure, Parky.
I like that in a fighter pilot.
What do they fly? I'm trying to work out what it is. It's a T-50.
Which is? I don't know what a T-50 is.
Lockheed Martin T-50. Isn't that? I thought that was a derivative of like a Hawk, is it not?
No.
Are you absolutely sure?
No.
Not Lockheed Martin.
Yeah, T-50. So there you go. That's what they fly, which is basically a US trainer. It sort of looks like.
No, the US don't have those.
I thought it was an indigenous aircraft that they.
Hang on,
this is out of a podcast. Hang on, he's going to win us awards. This bit.
Hang on, so the US, what do they use to train with? Goshawks, Hawks.
Yeah, US Navy T-45s, and I think they still use T-37s, T-38s, aren't they? Until they get into the new ones.
Not T-37s. They use Texans. back to Texans again, and. And they also use T-38, so they're getting a cockpit upgrade. They've had a cockpit upgrade on T-38, but that's what they use.
Is there a brand new trainer coming in as well?
There is. I can't remember what it is, though.
Boeing get selected?
Can't remember.
Yeah.
The T-50 is built by KAI, K-A-I. It's built in Korea, I think.
Yeah, you're right. In association with Lockheed Martin, I've got to say.
Big.
I can Google that afterwards.
Yeah, it's a nice looking jet, actually.
Right, we did. We could probably roll on for a million years talking about the boys' red stories. But, I did want to ask one thing. How was your flying test, Dunk, when you did it?
So I did my flying test with Justin Hughes, and it went all right. So Justin Hughes was the exec. So the exec got to do the flying tests, and I then... When I was and Bucky will have done the same thing because he was the exec, so it was a really cool thing to do the flying test with the boys. But that's not what you asked, so I'll try and stick to the stick brief. I'm going to do that again, JB, because it's. What's that?
Tell me all about Justin Hughes then.
Say again, mate.
Tell me all about Justin Hughes then.
Yeah, so what was the question again?
Your flying test. How was your flying test?
The flying test, I did my flying test with Justin Hughes, who's the exec at the time. So the way it would work is that all goods on the shortlist would do a flying test. And I'd say, Parky, I don't know if you'll agree, but it was probably... the biggest deal of the week doing the flying test.
It certainly felt it, didn't it?
There's a lot of pressure on, and you went to do something that you you really didn't or hadn't done before, and I did mine with Justin. And I remember just, I think it went okay. I just remember, though, getting to the top of one of the loops and feeling him push some rudder away from the other aircraft. So clearly I was getting a little bit too close for his comfort, maybe. And it's difficult. So, you know, I was the exec, Parky was the exec as well before me. So we got to go and do those flying tests too. And, it, you know, you don't know these guys particularly well. You know, clearly they've got an above average recommend to come to the Reds in the first place. But you've then got to go and do, well, two loops and two rolls. With these guys doing it first time, effectively.
Now, is your job there to be an outsider to audit what they're doing to make sure, you know, they're not too elite, if you like, they're accountable?
Sorry, are you still talking about flying tests?
Yes.
No, as the exec, no, you're part of the team. You're there to see if they're going to have the skill set to do the job.
Ah, right. I'm with you.
Did you see the one last night, JB?
No, I've not seen it. I will talk about something else I've seen later, but no, I've not seen that.
The one last night is worth a watch because I showed the guys, or some of the guys, and you can see a real difference in them. And I think, you know, I don't know whether the guys did, but it looks like a couple of the guys have maybe gone and done a couple of hawk hours first. And then one of the guys, who's a Typhoon guy, doesn't look like he's gotten a hawk since, you know, for a while.
How did he get extra hawk hours then? How would you do that?
I don't know. They still find T1s at Valley.
No, they don't fly them at Valley, but they do fly them at Leeming.
Yeah.
So you might go and ask if
you can get a back seat.
If you can just go and get in the aeroplane, so at least you're a little bit more familiar with it.
Crikey, that's a lot of taxpayers' money for. A bit more familiarity,
no, really,
isn't it?
They're going up anyway.
Yeah,
it's just that there's a spare back seat. So you wouldn't just go, right, can I have a dedicated... That wouldn't happen. But you might just... You'd get to go and... If there's a sortie OE and it would have a back seat free, you just go and climb into that.
Oh, I see. And then you can just fly for a little bit later on.
Well, yeah. Maybe. Sometimes you would and sometimes you wouldn't. You'd hope you might get the opportunity to do it, but it depends on the sortie. But even just actually just being a little bit more familiar with the aeroplane helps. Anything, every little helps, as Tesco says.
Absolutely. Okay, well, before we go, have we got any questions, Godders?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And I'm definitely going to read some of these out because I remembered about 5 minutes ago, but they've our people have come good. And we've got some questions in there. So there's one from Ian Savage. Heard the US Navy, the new US Navy carrier Electric Catapult cannot launch aircraft with external wing tanks. Have you heard? And if so, why can't they? Ooh.
Fascinating.
That's a question from Godders to himself.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that. I know there's something. It's called EMALS, the electronic magnetic.
I can't think of why they couldn't. Can you?
I don't know, but it's a brand new system. It's like the old James Bond tray on a magnet. If anything, you know, because you test it without external stores, then you'll test it with external stores.
Well, it must be something to do with the fact they're carrying external fuel. Because otherwise it'd mean they can't carry external stores, which would be, well, insane.
No, I think it's just probably little, you know, steps on the program. But certainly when we were doing F-35 trials... on the ski ramp, the ski jump at Patuxent River, the first time you did it, the guys did it empty, then they'd start putting more fuel in it, then they'd start putting more weapons into it, then they put external weapons onto it. So you just, it's graduated test points. So if Ian has that, it's probably that sort of thing.
Interesting.
This one's from Bren. Bren Fly Big Bird. Here we go. We've been talking about this. Tonka retirement after 40 years service. Long serving because it was so good or because it was a case of make do?
Oh, that's a long question to answer, isn't it? That's a debate.
Well, all right. So short answers then. What do you think, Doug?
No, I think, you know, it was what was required at the time, wasn't it? If you look back at to when it was designed and it Cold War bomber... To go in low, and you know, it had its terrain following radar, which enabled it to go in any weather, particularly low. You know, did you do the hard ride at TFR?
Yeah, I didn't like it at all. The whole thing scared me.
I'd love to do that. I'd love to do it.
Our brave Air Commodore again, ladies and gentlemen.
I don't mind admitting it. Hashtag me too.
And But so, you know, I think the short answer is I think it was designed for a job in a Cold War era, and it did that job very well.
Parky?
Yeah, I think annoyingly Dunk's nailed it, really. You know, and after that, the RAF are very good at you know, an old bit of kit, really, which is what it was, and, you know, the updates that they put on it. You know, the airframe was always pretty limited, and, you know, after probably, you know, getting into the 90s, you know, there were far more bits of far more agile aircraft, you know, operating. But it did its job. And, you know, with the kit that they put on it and the way it could, you know, drop precision weapons, just kept it useful, you know, for 28 years operational flying. You got to salute it for that. But, updates and how the RAF have maintained that aircraft is, you know, it's pretty impressive.
Do you think go on.
I was going to say exactly what Parky said there. You know, the ability to keep reinventing yourself to stay relevant has been key in that aeroplane.
Yeah,
you know, just brilliant the way that they've done it.
Do you think there's an element as well, which is airframes? Well, as a technology, are pretty mature now. So, I mean, if you've got a good airframe, it's the avionics which you continually need to upgrade rather than the actual airframe itself, which is going to be pretty steady. I mean, if you look at the stuff we're bringing in now, those airframes are going to be in service for many, many years. But the internals will be completely different by the time that they finally return.
Yeah, I guess all jets need to be, you know, either midlife update or, you know, just be able to have that update. You know, that obviously is the key to it. I mean, the F-16, to my mind, is just ridiculous how, you know, just the updates and how that aircraft transformed, you know, from the early ones to... Was it the Block 50 you flew Goddard's, and that was over a while ago? Even now, it would be far.
Yeah, that's 20 years ago. Yeah. It's from the CJs to the CMs, and the different. It's all about the different types of weapons to keep relevant.
So, Goddard's, have we got another question?
Yeah, here's a good one from Chris W. at C Walton 7.
Okay.
Let's try and get short answers on this one, but I think it's a good one. What did the chap see as the best display aircraft from RAF service over the past 100 years?
Wow.
Dunk, go.
Best display aircraft, flipping heck.
So past 100 years, I guess that we don't have to have seen it ourselves here. So this is sort of YouTube or Pate film or whatever it happens to be. What are you thinking, JB? You go first.
Well,
you've watched a lot of these things on YouTube.
The aircraft I'd love to see fly more than any other, actually, would be the Lightning.
Yeah, I think I'm with you. The original Lightning.
Yeah, full, you know, just as fast as it could possibly go.
And I've got one more. It would be, Dunk, who wrote Cypher and Merlin?
Oh, it was...
Alex Henshaw.
So I would have loved to have seen Alex Henshaw's display at the Castle Bromwich factory when he takes when he takes the aeroplanes out of there. There is, if you Google it, there is YouTube footage. There is footage, old footage, do it fire display. But apparently that was one of the most amazing things that that you could see.
Wow.
I have to say that the Vulcan.
Yes.
Definitely up there, isn't it? You know, that is an amazing aeroplane. I think, you know, to me, so you say about the Lightning, and I get that, but I'm not sure that the display itself, I think the aeroplane, amazing brute power, et cetera, but I'm not sure the display itself kind of did that brute power justice, because it just sort of went too far from the crowd, and, you know, it could do the high-speed pass pretty well. But, you know, to see a Vulcan and see that size of aeroplane maneuver as it does, I think that beat it, and it was amazing to see. It was it was great that the Vulcan to the Sky project came back, and, you know, it was very privileged to on my last trip actually with BBMF, we did a formation that had quite a few fighters, and then we had the Vulcan as well, and flying line astern to the Vulcan and watching it was just incredible.
Did you have to do some observation on the Vulcan? Have I got that wrong?
Yeah, you got that wrong. When Dunk saved to the Vulcan all by himself.
That's right, yeah. I saved.
He landed
wing walking, I heard.
Collapsed undercarriage.
And, it's that career day.
Exactly.
Do you know what? I would give you the Vulcan. Being selfish, I'd like to see all three beams together. That would be a phenomenal display.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool. That would be pretty cool.
Parco, any updates? I mean, I'll tell you what, I'm going to put this one out on Twitter.
It's seeing certain aircraft fly, or how well they display. And that to me, an actual display aircraft, the agility, you know, obviously you saw the F-22
couple
of years ago at Riyadh was pretty impressive.
I'd love to see that.
The thrust vectored. Do you remember we saw the first time we saw it, Dunk, I think was in Langkawi. We saw the thrust vectored flanker. And just some of the stuff, you know, I just remember probably watching it with Dunk just going, that is mental what that thing is doing.
It shouldn't be allowed to. Aerodynamic laws.
You know,
but you've cheated there, because that's not from RAF service, which was part of the question.
RAF service would almost go, you know, just watching the Typhoon now, you know, you gave it all the fast jets. You know, it's a cracking show. I never get bored of watching it. I always go and have a squint.
I must admit. Little tear comes to the eye. I'll put this out on Twitter and see what everyone thinks about their own. And we'll have a quick natter about that one next time. Time for one more?
Yes, absolutely.
Right, this is Kev at Kev1701E. I wonder if that means something. After a recent visit to RAF Scampton in minus temperatures, have any of you had a mishap on an icy runway? Good question.
No.
Well, I have. Don't you remember operating out of Bardufoss on the icy runway?
No, that's why I could say no quite clearly, because I never got to go to Bardufoss.
I think we've talked about this before, but
where is this place?
It's in northern Norway near Tromsø. So you're inside the Arctic Circle. Absolute bell detachment. We were there. I mean, you know, you could do a whole episode on just this place itself. It had a slope.
I'd be very quiet.
I had a slope approaching one of the, I think it was the easterly runway, that was a 7-degree slope. So you had to, in a hurry, you had to do a 7-degree vertical landing. And I think it was Johnny Earl Dunk who, and on ice, you landed at, what was a normal RVL, 50 knots?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it was 60 knots on ice, because with the nozzles pointed down, it was enough speed that you didn't get any ice come up into the intake and cause damage to the engine.
Ooh, yeah.
And Johnny landed right on the beginning of the runway at only 60 knots, you know, 70-odd miles an hour, but still almost slid off the far end of the runway, because it was just sheet snow and ice. You know, they don't bother clearing it up. The Jag used to use its, when the Jag would land, they'd use its brake parachute. But then when you taxied off, I remember taxiing off on one particular day, there was a slight incline downwards as you taxied off the runway. And I was just fully out of control in this Harrier skidding sideways. You'd put the throttle slightly through the high pressure gate and just turn the engine down as far as it would go without shutting the engine down. And you would also use the nozzles and point them forward if you thought you were going to lose control. So you had a bit of braking, and you also had a bit of to give you some directional control. And I remember I just about got control of this thing, got round to the hardened aircraft shelter where I was parked, and the ground crew started marshalling me around. And as I turned, the thing just slid sideways towards the shelter, and I thought, oh, I'm going to ram one of these big concrete shelters from the side. But the thing caught again, and I got round the corner and shut it down. But flipping heck, you know,
why
on
earth did you train there
all of the time?
What was the point of the detachment?
Well, for exactly that reason. At the time, so this was mid-90s, I mean, you know, post 1992, but there was still a buffer zone between the north of Norway and Russia. So we'd be flying right up to a few miles away from the Russian border at the top. And genuinely one of the most amazing detachments I've ever done. I love the Empire Strikes Back. Flying low level over Norway, it was like you were in a snow speeder.
Yeah, I bet. Did you have the cool white and green camo, which they put on the GR3s?
We didn't at that time. They used to put them, they put on the GR5s. I think they went back to them again at one point after I'd left the jet as well.
It's a great scheme, that.
But we went to Norway a couple of times, and yeah, I learned about icy runways and taxiways from that.
Yeah, it reminds me of the...
I might have accidentally done a 360 once in an F-16 taxiing out at Leeuwarden in Holland, where we operated from. I can remember just going, it was just before the runway. I think it was just the two F-16s and my leader was coming out of a hardened shelter just by the edge of the runway. And as I kind of came around the corner, I must have just touched the brakes. It was very skitty, the little F-16. And exactly as God has said, I just had this feeling as I went around the corner, like, oh no, I've lost it. And in slow motion, it did a complete right hand 360 as my leader came out of his shelter and looked at me as I did this beautiful pirouette and then sort of slid, not really close to him, but just kind of up where I probably should have parked anyway. And he sort of on the VHF radio went, whoa, are you all right? And I could see that, you know, it was just so slow on the ice and no damage had been done. It was like, yeah, I think I'm okay. And then we took off.
Excellent.
The whole transit to the airspace thinking, that was a bit weird.
Yeah. Excellent. Right, well, I think we will leave it there. That was a very, very good place to end it. Oh, actually,
you know, I have got, it's not a question, but I think we do have to mention this from Als G. Not a question per se, but how about a shout out to the guy who just made 6,000 hours on Tonkers on the last sortie? Do you think he rounded up?
Is anything like Parky he did?
Apparently, he got. I was talking to one of the guys at work today, and apparently, Old Stradders there got his. It was he ticked over 6,000 hours as they were over the Alps on the way back from Cyprus there. So, finishing the way we started with a big salute, 6,000 hours aircraft type. Unbelievable.
That is quite some achievement, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Hey, I'm afraid, you know, in standard fashion, I've got to give a shout out as well.
Oh, God.
I mean, it's not on the to the same extent as Strats with the 6,000 hours, but I've got a shout out to all the boys that make up the gliding school at Sun, because they listen to the podcast.
Oh, do they?
As it turns out, who knew? And Gary Weber, who flies there, very kindly sent me solo in a glider a couple of weeks ago.
You went solo?
I mean, they let me on my own.
My God. See, JB, yet another thing. So he's flown with the Reds. He flew a glider solo. He forgot to mention this at the beginning of the flow program.
Yeah, I didn't want to talk about Texans, though.
Didn't get a chance.
Unbelievable.
Didn't get a chance. But I couldn't get down.
Talking about that snuff movie, you threw him, you see.
He's very sensitive, actually.
I am. I'm a very sensitive individual.
You're not going to tell me that you had a quick go on an F-22 next week, are you?
Oh, yes, and then went on the space shuttle.
Didn't think much of it.
Nice.
Well, that, again, is a great shout out. In fact, as we are doing this, I've, you know, rounding up some business, I actually have something, and you boys are going to hate this. You're going to think it's really naff, but I don't really care. For Christmas, my wife bought me two books. She's bought me, First Light. And she's also bought me, I can't remember if it's Tumulus in the Skies or another one. But anyway, two books which we've spoke about on the podcast, but I've already read. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get you boys to sign them, and I'm going to give them away to a listener. So if you listen to this, you've got always at the end and you retweet it, we will send you a pair of books.
Wow, that's very cool. Both of those books are great. I just finished Tumult in the Skies as well.
It's good, great. Isn't it?
Yeah. Really good. Really good.
What did you think of First Light, JB?
I loved it. I thought, the first book I read was, I feel bad for not remembering his name now, the guy, 100 Aircraft.
Oh.
Eric Winkle Brown.
Yeah.
Wings on My Sleeve.
Which was great. But to be honest, it's a 100-paid book, and he's done something like 400 aircraft. So you can't possibly go into detail everything that he's ever done. So it's a very brief book. I thought First Light was just superbly written. Yeah. I mean, it's such a great balance of actually what it is like to fly in a fighter squadron, but beautifully presented too. So I loved it.
Yeah.
So that's a good idea. What are the list to do? What do they need to retweet?
What we'll do is we'll put this podcast up, and if you see the link, just simply retweet it. That's all we need to do.
What a good idea. And we'll sign it when we get together at our next adventure, which could be somewhere near a hybrid air vehicle or somewhere
else. Or a hotel.
Pretending to be on an aircraft carrier.
Yeah. So we will tweet. We will send you some books at some point.
That's a good idea. I like that. Well done.
Marvellous. Marvellous.
Excellent. Right. I guess I'll see you guys in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Let's hope we're flying a big balloon.
Yeah, so if you enjoyed what you heard, please tell a friend, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or whatever you download. And also you can follow us on Twitter, where you will need to be retweeting us. But until next week, from me, Godders, Dunk and Parky, we will see you then. So goodbye.
Cheerio.
Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.